LifeLock, how can I help?
The IRS said I filed my return,
but I haven't.
1 in 4 taxpaying Americans has paid the price of identity fraud.
What do I do?
My refund, though.
I'm freaking out.
Don't worry, I can fix this.
LifeLock fixes identity theft guaranteed and gets your money back with up to $3 million in coverage.
I'm so relieved.
No problem. I'll be with you every step of the way.
1 in 4 was a fraud-paying American. Not anymore. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/special offer. Terms apply.
City of Hope. A place where seemingly impossible blood cancers become treatable, curable. With more than 19,000 bone marrow transplants performed, we're the largest and most successful program in the U.S., making major breakthroughs in treating leukemia, lymphoma, and multiple myeloma, personalizing a treatment plan right down to your DNA. Now the experts striving to make the impossible a reality are closer to home. Learn more at cityofhope.org.
From GEICO Subconscious News, I'm Tammy Racing Thoughts. Tonight, you just left for work and had a non-specific feeling that something was happening to your place and it wasn't good. Dan?
Exactly, Tammy. It could be smoke damage, theft, or just too much caffeine, but you can't stop thinking about it.
But with renter's insurance through GEICO, your stuff is covered, so you don't have to worry.
And that's great, because the weekend is coming up and it's chock full of social obligations that are ready to fill that void.
Oh boy, will they, Dan? It feels good to worry less. It feels good to GEICO.
This is the Spycraft 101 podcast. Welcome to your clandestine classroom.
This is episode number 232 of the Spycraft 101 podcast. My guest for today is Michael Hirschman. Michael served as a special agent with U.S. Army Intelligence beginning in the late 1960s. He then went to work as an investigator for New York City, New York State, and then as a senior staff investigator for the Senate Watergate Committee led by U.S. Senator Sam Mervin. Later, he joined the Federal Election Commission as chief investigator and was responsible for audits and investigations of candidates and their campaign committees. After leaving government service, Michael founded the Fairfax Group in Fairfax, Virginia. For the past 40 years, Fairfax Group has helped tackle complex and sensitive challenges related to crisis and risk management, compliance, and security all over the world. I invited Michael onto the podcast to discuss his military service, his work as a U.S. government investigator, and the world of high-stakes private investigations, consulting, and risk management. But first, let me ask you this. Are you an amateur military historian like me? Has this podcast rekindled your interest in Eastern Europe and the Cold War? Maybe you're finally getting into reenacting and living history just like you've always said you would. If so, you should check out the incredible collection of surplus military goods at krasicki.com. Chris himself scours the world for the best uniforms and field equipment available and delivers them right to your door. He's got almost anything you can imagine and many things you haven't. Uniforms from East Germany, the Soviet Union, and modern-day Bulgaria, Poland, and Russia are all available. Rucksacks, mess kits, and load-bearing gear are also up on the site right now. The inventory is constantly changing, so you never know what kind of gems you might stumble on, all at very affordable prices. Find it all at krasicki.com. That's KRUSCHIKI.com. Or just click the link in the show notes of this episode and use the discount code SPYCRAFT101 for 10% off your order. Michael, thank you for being here.
Well, Justin, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on. And when you started to talk a little bit about my background, you might have convinced people that I was born during the Civil War. But I want to assure you, I'm not quite that old.
No, you're not. No, you're not at all. I promise. Hopefully they didn't get that impression. So I have not had the chance in the past to speak with anyone who's worked in and around Capitol Hill in the way that you have. So this is a real opportunity for me and hopefully for the listeners as well.
Yeah. So when I came down to Capitol Hill, during the Watergate investigation, I thought I was pretty sophisticated. I'd been working on corruption and organized crime cases in New York City for some years before I joined the Watergate Committee. And I guess I thought I knew just about everything pertaining to misconduct in government and in the private sector. But Watergate was a real eye opener to me. Well, the first few weeks, actually for the first month or so, I was wondering whether what we were doing was good for the country, because we were targeting, obviously, the conduct of the President of the United States and the office of the President of the United States. And being a patriot and looking up to the office of president for so many years, I was concerned. But as the evidence and facts began to build about breaches of what I call common sense and rule of law, I came to understand that something had to be done. And this was the right time, or that was the right time and place to do it.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to this discussion, because I admit it's been a long time since I've looked closely at Watergate. So I feel like I'm going to be rehearing or relearning a lot of things from you today. But Michael, let's go back to the beginning of your story. Actually, can you tell me a little bit about like your early life and what led you to join the military in the first place?
Yeah, so it was during the Vietnam War. I was in college. And as I mentioned, I had a strong patriotic streak in me. I witnessed a lot of demonstrations against the war and a lot of disenfranchisement of people regarding U.S. policy at that time. And I decided that I wanted to join the military. And for some reason, when I went in and took a battery of exams, someone in the military decided that I'd be well suited for intelligence, and particularly for an area of intelligence that dealt with counterterrorism. Some people back then called it counter-sabotage, but it really was counterterrorism. And so I became a special agent with U.S. military intelligence. I went through intelligence training at the U.S. Army facility. At that time, it was located in Baltimore, Maryland. Later, it was moved out west, and it still is out west.
Hmm. Okay. So yeah, I think I've heard of it. It's out like in Arizona, I believe.
Exactly.
Now. Yeah. I just talked to a retired Army agent pretty recently, as a matter of fact. So, but I think he had a very different career than you did. So was terrorism your primary focus?
Fort Huachuca.
Yeah. I've heard of that.
In Arizona.
Okay.
And there, the intelligence training is quite thorough. The Army has been doing it. Well, I should say that when I went through it, and I think this still may be the case, it was a joint military training facility. So when I went through the training, I was in training with folks that were also in the Air Force, the Marine Corps, and the Navy.
Hmm. Okay, I didn't realize that. So after you graduated, what kind of work did you focus on? Was it primarily terrorism for the remainder of your military career?
It was terrorism. This was an era, you know, We tend to think about today's environment as being volatile, and it is. No question, this country has changed, and there's a lot of dissatisfaction and happiness, but this is not the first time we've experienced this. Back again during Vietnam, you may recall that in addition to the demonstrations, by and large, covered by the First Amendment, there were bombings, there were assaults, there were attempted assassinations. It also was a difficult period in the history of our country. But one thing I've learned about our country, we're very resilient. And although we have areas on which we disagree, when it comes down to it, we're all Americans, and we all have got to come together to protect the underlying principles of democracy. And I'm hoping that we get past these difficult years so that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness comes together again in our country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something we all need right now, I think. So, Michael, what were the main threats at that time? I've talked to an agent, actually, it's possible you even work with him, maybe a guy named Bill Ray. I don't know if that name is familiar to you at all. He did a little bit of counterterrorism work in Germany in the 1970s, I believe. That it kind of came up briefly on the podcast when we talked about his career, but he was definitely focused on like Bader-Meinhof gang and people like that. Was that your focus as well?
Yes, in several different areas. Of course, the Bader-Meinhof gang, the Red Army faction, Black September, the Palestinian group. Mm-hmm. All of those were the focus of some of my efforts. And they had, of course, they were anti-imperialism, if you will, anti-capitalist. And back at that time, they were engaged in a series of assassinations. But they were also very much anti, although they were foreign groups, European, Japanese groups, Palestinian groups, they all had one thing in common. They were anti-American. And that also meant that they came together to work against our efforts in Vietnam. Hmm. And some of them were helping funnel resources in terms of money and weapons to the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese during that period, something that we were very concerned about. And in particular, because they had their own spy operation, if you will, intelligence operations, and they tried to subvert U.S. servicemen to come over to their cause.
Oh, wow.
Not only in Vietnam, but in other areas where the U.S. had its forces stationed.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay. I was not aware that the Vietnam angle of that, I kind of assumed something like that would be happening in Europe. So how did you and how did your colleagues kind of respond to this sort of thing? Were you like working on preventative measures or were you like investigating them jointly with local law enforcement or some other tactic?
We worked with local intelligence agencies throughout Asia and Europe, as well as with law enforcement, and some of the techniques that were used at that time are fairly well known. They include, this is really going to sound old-fashioned, but telephone intercepts. Of course, back then we didn't have cellular networks. It included mail cover. That is, once a terrorist was identified, we'd get a local intelligence agency or law enforcement agency to work with us to intercept whatever communications we could. We ran sources, obviously, human intelligence as well. Back then, we didn't have much in the way, well, we had nothing in the way of computers or AI. And so we relied much more on traditional intelligence techniques. We didn't have satellites. It was more about human sources and intercepting whatever electronic and mail correspondence we could.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, that sounds like a lot of, I wouldn't call it quite manual labor, but a lot of poring through paper records and that sort of thing, and a very long process to catch someone.
That you described it just right. It was a tedious process, but it was successful in many instances and tried our best and were somewhat successful in turning some of the targets to work with us, and where we couldn't turn a target, to inserting undercover folks into the organizations that we were targeting.
Oh, wow. That's a dangerous game to play, I'm sure.
It still is. Look, in some respects, the intelligence game has changed dramatically. And in others, we still use the tried and successful techniques of turning folks that are bad guys and inserting undercover or penetrating, if you will, their organizations. That still happens, and it's always been dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. It takes a rare kind of person to really insert themselves into that group. Was this American service members doing that, or was it local nationals, you know, in conjunction with the local intelligence agency that you mentioned?
Both. So we had local nationals working for us for the Department of Defense that we relied on very heavily because obviously they fit into the local environment, spoke the language, and some of them indeed were servicemen, but others were civil employees, if you will, of the Department of Defense and other related intelligence agencies, civilian employees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what a job. So did you experience a lot of success with that kind of thing? Did you kind of successfully preempt or mitigate any of the, you know, any planned attacks on, you know, U.S. assets or U.S. military forces, anything like that you can tell us about now?
We broke up a number of operations, particularly the ones that were of greatest priority to us were the ones where they were attempting to subvert U.S. servicemen through, again, techniques that are well known to the intelligence community. They look for weaknesses. A weakness might be financial issues. It could have been alcohol or drug use. It could have been a woman, or in the case of a female operative, a man. And we were successful in cutting off their penetration of some of our critical army bases. So what we found back then, and not just army bases. When I talk about bases, I'm talking about military bases, whether it be Army, Air Force, or otherwise. we found that they had infiltrated these bases by getting jobs. Could have been landscaping jobs. It could have been bartending at the clubs on base. And once they were inserted in those jobs, they would befriend the soldiers, find out which of the soldiers were unhappy for one reason or another or susceptible to their influences. And we were very successful in rooting out those terrorist groups and terrorist individuals that had infiltrated our bases.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. It sounds like you had your work cut out for you. Michael, do you think that at the time, I guess that the, you know, roughly around then the draft was still active. Do you think that made it easier for them to find soldiers that they could subvert? Because I presume that there were people in the military that were not really there by choice ultimately and had a real, you know, axe to grind with the U.S. Army. So do you think that the recruiting was easier?
Yeah, a very good point. Yes. I mean, look, not only were we dealing with the draft, but we also were dealing with folks that weren't quite sure we were doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And look, we see that in the modern military as well. Even though we don't have a draft, we do find that people become disenchanted by whatever U.S. policies are in force. And some of them, unfortunately, become spies. Some of them conduct sabotage to try to make our services less effective. So it's always important to have the counter surveillance in place to be able to determine who those folks are.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The secret is out. With millions of younger-looking customers across the country, Plexaderm is one of the most highly sought-after products on the market. It visibly shrinks under eye bags and smooths out crow's feet in minutes, and the effects last up to 10 hours. Influencers love it, magazines feature it, and people just can't get enough of it. As a matter of fact, Elle Magazine gave it an Editor's Choice Award as Best Instant Wrinkle Filler for 2025. In as little as 10 minutes, Plexaderm reduces the appearance of fine lines, wrinkles, and those dreaded under eye bags. So yes, you can look years younger in minutes, and the effects last for hours. No surgery, no gimmicks, just results. The best news, you can try Plexaderm for only $14.95. Plus, get free shipping. Don't wait. Order Plexaderm today. Visit Plexaderm.com/special. That's Plexaderm.com/special. Paid for by Sheer Science.
From Geico Subconscious News, I'm Tammy Racing Thoughts, broadcasting from your brain. Tonight's top worry, if something happens to your apartment and you need to, like, stay in a hotel and pay for it, that would be crazy, right? Art Palpitations has more.
That would be crazy, Tammy, but you got surprisingly affordable renter's insurance through Geico, so it could be covered, giving you peace of mind.
Aw, I love a story that ends well.
Next up, love stories. Are they all they're cracked up to be?
It feels good to worry less. It feels good to Geico.
Wow, that was quite a time period there for sure. And it definitely sounds like you had your work cut out for you.
Indeed.
So what led you to leave the military and go into like a civilian kind of service role eventually? Did you just do one tour or did you just find a better opportunity after 6 or 8 years?
I was always interested in law enforcement. And while I very much enjoyed my short military career in intelligence services, I wanted to work in the area of law enforcement. And so when I left the military, I joined the New York City Department of Investigation, which is a permanent agency, which dates back over 100 years, and which works on corruption cases within the New York City government and all the departments and agencies. And I followed that with a stint at the New York State Special Corruption Prosecutor's Office, which was part of the Attorney General's office at that time in New York. So I went into law enforcement, but went into law enforcement in sort of a boutique area of responsibility, dealing with misconduct within government agencies, whether those agencies be law enforcement, administrative, judiciary, or otherwise.
Okay, I see. And in these roles, were you a full law enforcement officer, like you had arrest powers and that kind of thing?
I did have arrest powers, absolutely.
Okay.
This was also during a time when we had to deploy intelligence gathering. There were agencies within New York City, within the state, while they weren't infiltrated by terrorist groups per se, they were infiltrated by organized crime. Back then, we called them the mafia. Mm-hmm. And their efforts were to subvert the pursuit of justice in and around New York. And so we had not only subpoena power, we had wiretapping authority. We ran grand juries. And we used the same or similar undercover techniques and information gathering techniques as I used in the more pure, if you will, intelligence services. Mm.
My gosh, yeah, I would have to imagine that working for, you know, city of New York, you know, largest city in the world, most international city in the world, that you had a full plate at all times.
It was fascinating. And of course, as I said earlier, that's what led me in my youth, in my lack of being humble, because I was working on some of the most extraordinary, complicated investigations in New York City, corruption investigations, to believe that I'd never witnessed anything new or anything more complicated than I had already seen in New York City. Boy, was I wrong.
So did you have any particular like memorable cases from that time period, any anecdotes or anything you can share with us? This would have been in the mid 1970s, I'm guessing.
Yeah. And, you know, we during that time took down the heads of city agencies, judges, prosecutors.
Oh, wow.
Unfortunately, police officers. This was, you may recall, Justin, that this was a period of time when there was a major police corruption investigation highlighted by a movie called Serpico.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure.
Well, when I was with the Department of Investigation, we supported the Knapp Commission Serpico investigation into police corruption. And there was a unit within the police department, New York City Police Department, called the Special Investigations Unit, which was primarily involved in narcotics investigations. And that entire unit, by and large, was corrupt. Serpico was a young police officer who was assigned to that unit and decided that he wouldn't participate in their corrupt activities, wouldn't take the money, wouldn't take the envelopes, wouldn't take the drugs. And as a result, he almost lost his life. He was shot in the head during an operation that was essentially a setup by some of his police colleagues, who not only mistrusted him, but thought that he might be a candidate to cooperate with the authorities. And in fact, he was.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So did you worked with him, or you interviewed him or anything like that? Or was this, you were there at the same time this was going on?
Yeah. Well, no, we supported the investigation during that time. Mm. One of my colleagues, David Dirk at the New York City Department of Investigation, was Serpico's, we call him handler, if you will.
Oh, wow.
Serpico wore a wire. We were the ones who supplied the equipment and instructions and support for that endeavor. He was shot in the head. He, of course, went out on, well, he testified, obviously, and there were a number of indictments. He went out on disability and moved to Europe because he felt that his wife was still in danger. Mm.
Yeah, I can imagine. Wow. So a lot of those guys from that unit ended up in prison themselves, or indicted and tried, at least?
Absolutely.
Dang.
Yeah.
So at what point then did you move on to the U.S. working for the U.S. Senate?
That's right. So one of my colleagues at the Department of Investigation, Deputy Commissioner, was appointed at the very, very beginning of Watergate. And when I say the beginning, it looked like, Justin, it was just a break-in at the Democratic National Committee headquarters. He was made the assistant counsel for the Senate Watergate Committee. And I was at that time with the New York State Special Corruption Prosecutor's Office. He called me and asked if I would come down to help with the investigation of the break-in. And I asked my boss at that time, the special prosecutor, if I could take a leave of absence for a couple of weeks to go down and help. And I was able to do that, but that couple of weeks turned into a couple of years, because it turned out a little bit more complicated than we first thought. it wasn't just about a break-in at the DNC, but it was about, again, the subverting of the rule of law, the subversion of the justice system, and a number of the other high crimes and misdemeanors. Mm-hmm. I was not familiar with national politics. You know, I had dealt with city politics and state politics in New York, but had not been involved in U.S. Congress, the executive branch. In fact, I'll never forget, I drove down to Washington, D.C., and I had to ask someone how to get to the Senate office building to find out where I was going to be working. I had no clue where it was. But on short notice, Senator Sam Ervin, the chairman of the committee, and the vice chairman, Howard Baker, senator from Tennessee, threw together a small but a very effective group of lawyers and investigators and researchers and support staff to undertake what I still think probably was the most important congressional investigation in the history of our country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Michael, if you don't mind, can you start and just kind of give an overview of what happened? Because I think a lot of listeners, particularly my younger listeners, are, you know, probably only like vaguely familiar with Watergate as a concept. So like, who did the break in and what were they looking for? And how did that, you know, turn into a Senate investigation and that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, that's a very good point. There are a lot of folks out there today that may remember the word Watergate, but don't really know much about it.
Right.
So the president at that time, Richard Nixon, was up for re-election. He was Republican. He had already served one term, or was finishing his one term in office. And he and his top staffers were very paranoid about the election and losing the election. And, you know, they had a sense of arrogance that led them to believe that they were the only people who really could address the nation's problems. And so they could not afford to lose this election. And they created a group, an ad hoc group called the Plumbers, that were essentially assigned the task to gather intelligence on the opposition. That led this group, and some of them were affiliated with the CIA. Some of them, in fact, were Cubans by heritage who had worked for the United States in trying to overthrow the government of Fidel Castro. Their handlers, by and large, were experienced Justice Department or CIA operators, and they came up with a plan to break into the Democratic National Committee headquarters, which was located at a building called Watergate. They did a little bit of a sloppy job in that break-in, and a security guard in the building found that one of the doors during the course of the break-in had been taped so that it wouldn't lock behind the illegal entry of the plumbers, and called law enforcement, and the police responded, and arrests were made. And, you know, thinking back on it now, it was a stupid thing to do. And if at that time, Richard Nixon and John Ehrlichman and Haldeman, who were his chief staffers at that time, and said, you know, this was stupid. We didn't realize that they were going to go this far when we asked them to gather information. We would have never done, if they had done a mea culpa, it may have been over. But instead, they decided to try to cover it up. Mm-hmm. And in trying to cover it up, it became far more serious and far more detrimental to the country. Because number one, they had to start finding money to pay hush money, to pay for the silence of the perpetrators. And once you start down that road, whatever crime you have committed, it becomes far more serious when you engage in a cover-up. Because the cover-up consists of lies and misinformation and misdirection that build and build and build until it reaches the point where there's a point of no return, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so the subversion of the justice system, the subversion of what I keep referring to the rule of law, was what really led to the downfall of the presidency of Richard Nixon, who was reelected, but then resigned. He was likely going to be impeached. The arrest and prosecution of a number of high-ranking government officials, and the ruin of many careers.
Mm-hmm. So how long were you assigned to this investigation?
About 2 years.
2 years, my gosh. What
About
was
a
day-to-day like for you? Was it just interviews after interviews, or was it, you know, something else entirely?
Interviews, research. We executed a lot of subpoenas on the administration. We had literally tons of documents to work through. Some of the documents were shredded. We had to hire college students part-time to spend hour after hour putting together these shredded documents. A lot of our time was prepping the senators on the hearings, the public hearings that took place, working with the Watergate Special Prosecutor's Office. A special counsel was indeed created by the Justice Department to investigate the circumstances surrounding Watergate. It really was a 24/7 job. Of course, I, like many of my colleagues on the Watergate Committee, we were young and had plenty of energy at that time, and we were dedicated to not only finding out the truth, but making sure, or trying to make sure, that something like this wouldn't happen again.
Mm-hmm.
Because as a result of the Watergate investigation, as a result of the Watergate prosecution, Justin, a lot of laws were changed at that time. Laws governing everything from campaign financing to ethics rules and laws governing the conduct of government officials. It was an extraordinarily exciting time, a frightening time, and it was a time when we were being covered 24/7 by the media.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about the old line media. I'm not talking about social media, but every one of the major networks, every one of the major news outlets, whether it was the Washington Post, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, everyone was covering this. And anytime we walked out of our offices in the Senate office building, a group of reporters would converge on us. But this also changed the world of journalism, because the reporting by the Washington Post, Woodward and Bernstein in particular, the investigative journalism that they did, was the beginning of the creation of a whole new workforce, if you will, of aspiring investigative journalists. Woodward and Bernstein became famous. They were the ones that recruited The Source, who became known as Deep Throat,
mm-hmm.
who gave them a lot of inside information, who later turned out to be a very senior official at the FBI. And so from that point on, journalism was changed forever.
Mm. I was going to ask you about Deep Throat. I'm glad that you brought him up. I believe the guy's name was Mark Felton, wasn't it?
That's exactly right. Mark Felt.
Okay, yes. I see. Was his work with Woodward and Bernstein, was that hindering or enabling your investigation in any way? Like, was this guy a thorn in your side for disclosing stuff, or was it, you know, kind of helping keep the pressure on?
It was enabling not only from keeping the pressure on, but frankly, we were learning information through the publication of the Post and their articles that were helpful to the conduct of our investigation.
Oh, my gosh.
You have to remember now, I was still in my 20s at this time, and it's pretty heady to see yourself on television sitting behind the senators, handing them notes, helping them form their questions. It was an extraordinary time for anyone, much less a young investigator as I was.
I'll bet. So did you know who Mark Felt was at the time without knowing
No.
that he was Deep Throat?
Okay. No one knew who he was, and it didn't become known until many, many years later.
Yeah, not that long. Well, like 2005 or something.
After he passed away, yes.
Mm-hmm. yeah, that was a big shocker, I think. And I had no idea. I was, you know, before my time, so I didn't know much about it, but I could tell.
Oh, go ahead. Rub it in, Justin. Yeah.
I was not watching the news in the mid-1970s. I'll put it that way. How about that? I was not paying attention to the news. But yeah, I mean, that had to be incredibly heady investigation. And the media, were they looking for a scoop from you? Were they trying to get you to sit down for an exclusive or trying to form resources, something like that?
Absolutely. And they were successful, although in my case, coming out of law enforcement, I had a healthy respect for journalists, but I knew my background was such that I knew that I had to stay away from any form of cooperation. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't in my DNA. But others on the Senate Audit Committee and within the special prosecutor's office found themselves providing them with information.
Mm-hmm. Michael, do you remember, was there like a particular point in the investigation for you, at least, where you kind of realized that this went all the way to the president or would ultimately involve the president in some way? Was that like a shocking kind of thing, or did it just develop gradually?
Again, when I started, I had mixed emotions. I really felt, oh my God, what are we doing to the country? We're investigating the office of the president, not only the president, but you know, the attorney general and some of his key staff members. And is this the right thing to do? But again, as the evidence became more damning, I didn't get shocked. I got angry. I really got pissed, if you will, that people in power that were responsible for making decisions that affected everyday Americans, good decisions, bad decisions, or otherwise, would see themselves above the law. And so I became even more motivated to get to the truth.
So, I think just about everybody knows that ultimately, as you mentioned, this led to his resignation because he was facing impeachment. Do you think if he had not resigned, like what would have happened if he had been impeached? Would he have been found in contempt of something?
Yeah, I do think he would have been impeached. And I think there's a possibility he would have actually gone to prison.
Oh, wow. Wow. Okay. Was resignation appropriate in this case? Was that, I mean, ultimately he would have, you know, faced, you know, other even more grave consequences than you think?
Yeah, I think it was not only appropriate, but he had no choice. You know, he expected that his replacement, the Vice President Jerry Ford, would take whatever steps were necessary to move forward and not see him in prison and to try to heal the country. So it was in everyone's best interest, including the president, that he resigned.
Okay. So I know that, well, I assume anyway, that you met quite frequently with Senator Ervin. Did you ever meet President Nixon or speak to him at all during this time?
I did not, although one of my colleagues on the Senate Watergate Committee, Rufus Edmondson, who was deputy chief counsel, actually served him a subpoena.
Oh, wow.
But he never testified before us, nor was he ever called before a grand jury by the Watergate Special Prosecutor's Office.
Hmm. Was that going to happen, you think, had he not resigned, he would have been called to testify?
Yes.
Dang.
Yes.
Boy, that would have been something else to see.
Yeah, no question he would have been called to testify.
Hmm. After he resigned, did you stay on? Did you continue with the indictments of the other officials and trials and that sort of thing? Or was your time mostly over at that point?
I stayed on to help write the final report, which included a series of recommendations. And then I was appointed to a joint presidential congressional commission, which has the record for the longest name in these sorts of commissions history, the National Commission for the Review of Federal and State Laws Relating to Wiretapping and Electronic Surveillance. We called it the National Wiretap Commission.
Hmm.
But it consisted of four senators, four congressmen, and seven members appointed by the president. And it was a commission that was formed to review how effective the electronic surveillance laws, both the criminal laws and national security laws that allowed for electronic surveillance through court orders, how effective it had been in controlling crime and corruption in the country.
Hmm. What were the findings of that commission?
The findings was that it was a justifiable tool in the, when used properly, a justifiable tool in the investigation of criminal activity and espionage.
Okay. Did that ultimately lead to something like FISA, for example, or was that like years and years down the road?
That came a bit later, but they did rely on part of our findings.
Oh, really? Okay. Was that your?
We also, by the way, I should say, and this was not easy. We investigated illegal wiretapping in the country, which during that time was very prevalent, by the way, used by the private sector, the private investigative sector, during the course of their investigations.
Hmm. Oh, really? Like, are you talking about private investigators or corporations or organized crime or all three, maybe?
Well, primarily private investigators and those that were hired by corporations or individuals.
Hmm. And were they just getting away with it at that time then? I mean, was it pretty rampant?
It was rampant. Absolutely rampant. And it was improper, but it was not really seen as a priority from a law enforcement standpoint. And the way we investigated it at the National Wiretap Commission is we subpoenaed the records of the companies that manufactured the electronic surveillance equipment to see who they were selling it to.
Hmm.
And so we kind of use what I call a backdoor approach to identify those folks who were buying the equipment so that we could confront them on the use of that equipment.
Hmm. That's smart. So did that result in some in more prosecutions or law changes or both?
It resulted in much greater investigative prioritization of illegal wiretapping. It led to indeed the arrest and prosecution of a number of people. Look, I'm not going to suggest that illegal wiretapping, electronic surveillance is not still going on, but it's clearly not anywhere as prevalent as it was back in the 70s, 60s and 70s.
Okay, interesting. I'm kind of envisioning it like alligator clips on a telephone wire. Is that how it was being done? Like a, you know, hooked to a tape recorder or something like that?
Well, it was obviously the equipment was a lot less sophisticated back then, but they did have, what you might consider miniaturized bugs, not by today's standards, but they were subject to old technology, which meant, for example, if they were battery operated and placed in an inconspicuous place in a room, you had to go back every so often to change the batteries.
Oh, sure.
Of course, the way around that was to use existing electric wires to power these devices. And some of these devices were placed in telephones, and they ran off the power that was generated by the telephone itself. We would laugh today at how unsophisticated some of these devices were, but they were... These devices were kind of fantasized in some ways by movies. I don't know if you remember the James Bond movie where you had a bug in the olive in a martini glass. But yeah, there was a very thriving manufacturing industry to manufacture these devices.
Hmm. Interesting. I recall that film with Gene Hackman called The Conversation. I don't know if you've seen that one before.
Yeah, of course. Sure.
I think he even goes to like a wiretapping trade show at one point in the film.
Yeah, they weren't, all the absolutely. There were literally no controls at that point.
Mm. Wow. That's a great movie, by the way. I really enjoyed that one.
Any movie that Gene Hackman was in was a great movie.
Yeah, no question about it. He's one of the greats of all time. So at what point, Michael, did you decide to move into private industry yourself and found Fairfax Group?
I stayed in government for a while longer after the wiretap commission. I think you mentioned I was the first chief investigator for the Federal Election Commission.
Oh, right, right, right.
And then I went into the State Department and on issues related to corruption in the Foreign Assistance Program. After spending some years in this, I'm sorry, I skipped over one important diversion, if you will. I went back to the Hill, the House of Representatives, to work on another gate investigation. We called it Korea Gate. And it was an investigation into the bribery and subversion of U.S. politicians and U.S. institutions by the Korean, at that time it was called the KCIA, the Korean CIA, which was created by our CIA as the leading intelligence organization of the Republic of Korea. And we had hearings on that, and there were prosecutions on that, where some congressmen went to prison for taking bribes from the Korean government. You'd wonder why, in some instances, this was at a time, by the way, when Korea was still very much a developing country instead of an industrialized nation like it is today. And they relied on United States economic assistance, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And some of the bribes to congressmen were, senators and congressmen were, to ensure their support for getting economic assistance through legislation. But I'll tell you one interesting story that has an intelligence angle. One of the ex-heads of the Korean CIA, the director, the former director of the Korean CIA, had left the agency and moved to the United States, to Maryland, suburban Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C. We were lucky enough to recruit him to tell us about some of the activities of the Korean CIA in the United States. Some of them I just described in terms of bribery of congressmen and senators. Others had to do with harassing, assaulting, kidnapping Korean dissidents in the United States who opposed the then dictatorship in the Republic of Korea, which was a brutal dictatorship that had no regard for human rights, many political prisoners. In any event, they Korean CIA had infiltrated many institutions in America, and that was part of the focus of our investigation.
My gosh,
the
incredible
Korea Gate investigation. And so we convinced the former director of KCIA to testify before our committee, the Korea Gate Committee. I was the chief investigator for this committee. And shortly before he was to testify, I got a call from the State Department, and they said that they had just been alerted by the NSA, the National Security Agency, that there was an intercept of a conversation, telephone conversation, with the Korean embassy in Washington, D.C., and one of the committee members on our committee, one of the congressional committee members, alerted the embassy that the former director of the KCIA was cooperating and about to testify.
Oh, my gosh.
That resulted in the Koreans sending a hit team to Maryland to assassinate him. And we got, just frankly, just in time, we had the U.S. Marshals get to him and take him and his family into protective custody.
Wow. Wow. A hit by the Korean government inside the United States. That's incredible.
I mean, you never know. That's the thing about the intelligence business and the investigation business. You never know what direction it's going to take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt. I've heard some things here and there about KCIA during that time period, but I was not aware that they were doing that here in the United States. I heard a lot about what was actually going on, you know, on the peninsula
there, but yeah, that's
there is analogies to today. Foreign governments, the Chinese and North Korean governments, they have infiltrated our society, and they do target dissidents in not only in our country, but dissidents that are in Europe and other countries outside of the home country, whether it be North Korea, China, or Russia. And they are very aggressive in trying to silence these people. And even today, there are renditions, kidnapping of dissidents. And I've been involved in some of those cases the year.
Yeah, I've seen a few here and there. Iran has hired some proxies here and in Canada to kill people. I know the Indian government, you know, had this Sikh leader in Canada killed a couple of years ago, I believe, and just a lot of stuff going on. So I guess when the stakes are that high, they're willing to take these enormous risks, and you know, they don't always pay off, of course.
Yeah, and completely understand. Yes, understandable.
Wow. Amazing stuff. I'm gonna have to read more about that. I was not aware that they tried to target the former KCIA leader here in the United States. That's new to me. Well, so it just sounds like you've worked on every kind of scandal and corruption under the sun by this point then.
At that point, again, I was with the State Department, and it was during the late 70s when there was another turning point in the history of our country. And it was under the presidency of Jimmy Carter, where something called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was enacted. First of its kind in history. And essentially, it criminalized the bribing of foreign officials by U.S. corporations in order to obtain business or retain business overseas.
Hmm.
It came into being because of a huge scandal, a bribery scandal that involved a U.S. corporation bribing a member of the royal family of Japan at that time.
Hmm.
That became public and damaged the relationship between the United States and Japan, and opened the eyes of the president and Congress to the evils and the potential dangers of this form of bribery. So here I was in the State Department monitoring the legislation, working on the legislation, and I saw a business opportunity. I guess inside of me, there was something that I hadn't noticed before called entrepreneurship. And a lot of firms at this point, U.S. firms and Canadian firms and European firms, bribed foreign government officials, as a matter of course, to get business. They would classify the bribes as marketing expenses or some other form of cover. And all of a sudden, at least from the American firm standpoint, they didn't know what to do. And so I saw a business opportunity, and I left, and I formed the Fairfax Group, in part to work with the multinational corporations in the United States at that time to help them to avoid becoming victims, I guess, of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. As years went on, of course, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act became internationalized, and now there are treaties around the world that prohibit the same sort of behavior on the part of European firms and other firms.
Hmm. Interesting. That's a huge leap, in my opinion. You know, like you said, jumping from government service to entrepreneurship like that. How did you get your very first client? Did you have somebody expressing an interest before you'd even formed the group, for example? Or, you know, was it a short period there where you were looking for clients once you founded it?
That's a great question. I had no clue what I was doing because I'd never been in private industry. I mean, I had a short stint. My family had been in real estate in New York, and I had a very short stint after I got out of the military and before I joined the Department of Investigation working in real estate. But other than that, I had no experience. I didn't even know how to create a corporation. And when I finally got the papers to create a corporation, I realized I needed a name. And so I was not terribly inventive, but I was living in Fairfax County actually not far from CIA headquarters. And so I called it the Fairfax Group. And I didn't have much money coming to me. I had some pension funds coming from the federal government. At that time, it was like $10,000. I was married. I had a son, and I took a chance. I took my pension fund, set up an office in the basement of my home with a plastic desk and a rotary phone. And I was fortunate enough to, through my years working on the Hill and in the executive branch, to have made some very good contacts in the legal community. And one of the first calls I got was from a former Watergate special prosecutor. His name was Henry Ruth, who was now in private practice in a law firm in Philadelphia. And he said, "Michael, I have a client that has a problem, and I think they can use your help." And I said, "Henry, I really appreciate the call, because I literally been just establishing my business, and I'd love to help." And he introduced me to General Electric, the general counsel's office. And it was a case of industrial espionage, where General Electric was the victim, they believed, of the theft of proprietary information, trade secrets, by former employees of theirs. And I worked on that case very, very hard and diligent. And at the end, it turned out to be the largest industrial espionage case in the history of the United States. There were prosecutions, and it wound up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, it's kind of being at the right place at the right time, but it put the Fairfax Group on the map. And we became known not only in the area of anti-corruption through the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, but working for large corporations on sensitive issues that could have an adverse impact on the corporation.
I'm just stunned, Michael, that your very first client when you went out on your own is GE, of like one of the biggest companies in the world, certainly at the time. That's absolutely incredible that you were able to nab them like that through your friend and your former colleague there. That's an incredible start for the group.
If you think you were stunned, imagine me. I mean, they so I wound up putting an undercover agent inside of GE, an engineer. Because in doing preliminary investigative work, I found very quickly that these former senior level employees who had stolen this proprietary information and now were manufacturing very critical components and selling them as genuine GE components. These are components that went into very high cost turbines, gas turbines. I knew that they, in order for them to be successful, they would have to continue to get updated proprietary information. And the surest way I knew that for us to catch them doing that was putting someone inside that they could bribe. So I used my former intelligence experiences in enlisting undercover people to find, it wasn't easy to find someone that had an engineering background and would be able to fit in a highly technical environment, but we did it and we made the case.
Amazing. Was working as a private investigator, was that drastically different from what you had previously done? Because I have to assume, for one thing, that you have a very different type of leverage that you can use in any interview, for example, as well as, you know, legal restrictions, legal authorities, and that sort of thing.
Well, look, first and foremost, this, I was now in an era where the private investigative industry was changing dramatically. Okay. You know, in the 50s, 40s, 50s, 60s, into the 70s, private investigators, as characterized by television and the movies, you know, they were gumshoes. They kind of specialized in cases having to do with marital issues and missing cats and dogs. I say that tongue in cheek, but we began to professionalize our industry to understand that if we were going to service not only corporate America, but foreign corporations, if we were going to service governments, we had to professionalize. And we had to bring into our industry folks with legal backgrounds, with accounting backgrounds, folks that came out of the senior levels of the FBI, senior levels of the military and intelligence services. So we, and I count myself, I mean, I know it sounds immodest, but I count myself amongst some of my other colleagues as one of the change agents for our profession. Up till then, private investigators had somewhat of a disreputable reputation. And having worked in both the federal government, state and local government on areas related to ethics and anti-corruption, I wanted to make sure that our industry followed a set of rules, followed a set of standards that assured integrity and accountability. And again, it was not just me at the time. There were a number of other organizations. Kroll is one of them that Jules Kroll founded in, and he was of a similar mind as I was about professionalizing the industry. And we set about doing that. And now we don't even refer to ourselves as private investigators. We are crisis management specialists. We're risk specialists. Our industry has become far more sophisticated. It's had no choice but to become far more sophisticated because the world has changed. Mm-hmm. We're now in a world of cybersecurity. We're now in the world of AI. We're now in the world of Bitcoin and cybercurrencies. Far more sophisticated criminal, multinational criminal activities. And we have to be, we have to try to be one step ahead of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine it's just such an ever-changing world out there, and it's very hard to keep up because they will, the adversary will change their tactics as well every time you've caught up with them, I would imagine. So you have to be as proactive as possible.
Well, particularly, for example, in the world of cybersecurity. You know, the minute you find a way to prevent, let's say, a hack, the other side is just as sophisticated, if not more so, and they'll find a way around it. So technology it advances so quickly. Time is dead and distance is moot. You have got to be working, thinking 24/7 about how to keep ahead of the bad guys in order to protect the interests of your clients.
So it's clear that Fairfax Group has changed tremendously since you founded it. How large has it grown altogether or at its height?
Well, we've gone through a number of transformations. In the late 80s, we merged with a competitor organization called Decision Strategies, run by Bart Schwartz. Bart was the former head of the criminal division of the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. He worked for Rudy Giuliani, who was the U.S. Attorney at that time in the Southern District. And we were friendly competitors. And when I say that, what I mean is that if I had a client come to me and I couldn't take the case because there was a conflict, I had the confidence in Bart and Decision Strategies to refer that client to them. I knew that they would be treated fairly, and I knew that Bart and his company respected the integrity and the accountability that we promoted in our industry. And he would do the same thing if he had a conflict. So we found ourselves looking at a changing landscape, where at that time, the accounting firms, and at that time we were talking about, I think, the Big Six rather than the Big Four, were breaking into our industry. And they had an advantage over us in that they had very deep pockets and they had offices throughout the world. Now, I had offices both domestic and overseas, as did Bart. And we decided bigger was better. And so we merged our company and called it DSFX, Decision Strategies Fairfax. this happened to be, for us, a very good combination because it gave us the depth of resources and the international access we needed to compete at that time. Not long after we merged, one of our clients, long-term client, decided that they wanted to expand the services they offered, and they acquired our company. Now, this was, interestingly enough, it was just prior to 9/11. And I led a division of this. This is a public company, New York Stock Exchange company, multi-billion dollar company. And I led this company into, again, a new world, a world after 9/11. And we became extremely successful as part of the acquisition. And this is typical in any industry. I signed a contract to stay and lead the new group for 3 years. Bart had left even before then because he had a medical issue. And then after the 3 years, that same entrepreneurial spirit attacked me again. And I said, okay, I've been in the public company environment, reporting to analysts and watching the stock market and our own stakeholders and stockholders, if you will. But it's time for me to go back to my roots. And so I left and reformed the Fairfax Group. And we've been at it ever since. I feel very fortunate. I've had some wonderful people working for me and with me over the years, and some terrific clients from all over the world, some of them government agencies, some of them Fortune 500 companies. And I feel that we have provided a valuable service to help them stay out of trouble, or in the case where it's too late, to mitigate the risk and the trouble they've been in.
Hmm. Michael, can you give maybe like an example of like a typical client that you have right now, like how they contact you, what their problem is, and how you assist them, you know, maybe without going too specific, for example?
Well, look, a lot of our work has to do with, I mean, look, we still have the Foreign Corrupt Practices work, although under this administration, there's been a de-emphasis in Foreign Corrupt Practices investigations. They're more now focused on activities that have to do with cartels and government corruption.
Hmm.
One of the things that over the years I did also that the business has now changed is monitorships, where a company would get in trouble for one reason or another, but let's stick with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act for clarity. They would be accused of bribery, and as part of the solution, the Justice Department or the regulatory agency, the SEC, would require them to take a monitor for a period of years to make sure that their compliance programs and governance programs were brought up to a level to assure that this sort of conduct wouldn't happen again. And I was appointed monitor for a number of companies over the years. Now we're facing much more of the internal employee misconduct. Again, corporate espionage, workplace misconduct, sexual harassment, or workforce defamation, and trying to make sure that the rules of governing conduct are strict enough and informative enough so that employees know the difference between right and wrong, and when they stray, to help the corporations with the investigation of those allegations of misconduct. A lot of our business as well has to do with due diligence, particularly looking at corporations work overseas and the risk involved, and helping them identify the right sort of partners overseas to ensure that the people, whether it's vendors they're employing or distributors they're employing or agents they're employing, are people of integrity and are not going to violate the corporate rules and regulations So it's quite a diverse practice. Much of it has to do with cybersecurity. Some of it has to do with money laundering and issues related to privacy, which has become a very important aspect of life today, both in this country and overseas.
Certainly. Wow, sounds like a full plate there, certainly.
It keeps us, it's diversified and keeps us busy. And I will say, in my case, keeps me on my toes.
I'll bet. Are you personally running like day-to-day operations for the company, or are you focused on something else like the next 5 years, for example, or, you know, client acquisition, something like that?
I'm very much personally involved, but I have also brought my son into the business, who has experience actually with some of my competitors, because 5 years ago, one of my clients, multi-billionaire who runs a very large organization or ran a very large organization, got ill and was dying a little over 5 years ago and asked if I would be a trustee and help the organization after his death. And I've been very much involved in that over the last 5 years. So I'm multitasking, but at the same time, I've always had a philosophy that is centered on social responsibility. So I also have a civic organization hat that I wear, and on the board of directors of organizations like the Center for International Private Enterprise, the Coalition for Integrity. I sit on the board of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. I'm a founder of an organization, an NGO, non-governmental organization, nonprofit organization called Transparency International that was founded back in 1983. And as the largest global organization, nonprofit, non-governmental, that addresses the issue of corruption in the private sector and the public sector. They have about 100 chapters in 100 countries around the world. So I've always tried to devote 20% of my work to the nonprofit sector to try to make the world a little bit of a better place. Sometimes it seems to me I'm paddling against the current. But it's important to try to give back to the communities in which you serve, the communities in which you work, whether that's a country or the local communities in which you work in.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Absolutely agree.
And I know you're a Virginian. I was also the chairman of the Board of Trustees of Marymount University in Arlington, Virginia.
Oh, cool. Very cool. It sounds like you are not one to take things slow at all, Michael. I'm surprised that you even had time for this interview at this point, honestly.
You know, if you want to get something done, ask a busy person.
I've never heard that before, but it makes a lot of sense. Oh, amazing stuff. So, Michael, what do you think is in the future for you and for Fairfax Group as well? I mean, do you you talk about things are constantly evolving. What do you think are like the threats or the risks that you'll be trying to, you know, face over the next few years?
We've become very well known in the area of what's integrity. A few years back, I was appointed to the Independent Governance Committee of FIFA, which is the international governing body for the world of soccer.
Oh, wow.
Although in Europe, they call it football. This was a very powerful, is a very powerful, probably the most impactful sports federation in the world, because soccer is the most watched sport in the world and generates more money than probably the NFL, NBA, and Major League Baseball all put together. And they were the target of a huge scandal that was, frankly, publicized and prosecuted eventually. And I was part of a team that went in, and this was in Zurich, and we spent 2 years trying to, again, build adequate compliance and governance programs within FIFA to ensure that going forward, they operated by best business practices. The world of sports has changed. It's big money. It is subject to same forms of coercion and corruption that we find in any business today. Just today, it was announced that an indictment came down in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania against a number of NCAA colleges because some of their basketball players fixed 29 college games, Tulane, St. Louis University, DePaul, Fordham, some of the biggest names in basketball. You know, we're facing a world where organized crime has become far, and I'm talking about multinational organized crime, has become far more sophisticated, always looking for more ways to make their ill-gotten gains or increase their ill-gotten gains. And sports has become a target of theirs. And so they are infiltrating and have infiltrated the world of sports, both at the professional and amateur level, if there is anything anymore called amateur sports. I'm not sure that we can even consider college sports amateur anymore because of the money flowing through or into college sports. And it's unfortunate because it is a real ethical challenge to police these sports organizations today.
That's incredible. And yeah, it sounds like a place that they're just rife with corruption and opportunity, you know, as you mentioned. And, you know, I can't imagine some of the stuff that's going on there with so much money on the line for so many people.
Yeah, it's, I did a TED talk on the issue of, I call it purity in sports. You know, we're in a different era. When I played sports in school, elementary school, high school, it was more about having a good time than winning. Sure, winning was important, but frankly, you know, we'd play a game and then we'd go out for pizza with our opponents and laugh and have a good time. Now it's worth your life to even just attend a little league game. Appearance can be so antagonistic and so pushy. You know, they parents want to live through their kids and make sure their kids get scholarships to college and get the big NIL bucks these days. I'd hate to be a coach or a referee or an umpire today. They're subject to, you know, tirades, and some of them have been assaulted. And there's actually been referees and umpires killed because of what's perceived by their conduct on the field. So we kind of lost the purity that I experienced in sports. And this is what I talked about in my TED talk. I miss those days. It's hard to remain loyal, let's say, to a college team or basketball, football, whatever it might be, when their stars are leaving every year for bigger and better pastures and more money to the competing teams.
Oh, yeah, things have just changed drastically, no question about it. Yeah, I can see that Fairfax Group will probably have a lot of work to do on that for years to come, I would imagine.
I would think so. I wish we could go back in time, but like everything else, that seems impossible. We can already try our best to make sure going forward that we have enough checks and balances in place to hope that a level of ethics and integrity are restored to the sports industry.
Absolutely. Well, Michael, this has been an incredible conversation. I really appreciate your time today. It sounds like you've been present for so many, honestly, just like pivotal moments in American history and even in our international relations as well. It's really astonishing that you've been at the right place in the right time so many times in your life.
Well, I can consider myself very fortunate. And when I earlier on said right place at the right time, I meant that. I have been lucky to work on some of the most meaningful issues in government and in private sector in modern history. And I appreciate the time that you've taken today to speak with me.
Sure. Of course, I love the opportunity. And I certainly learned a lot from you as well. Do you have like a personal website or social media or anything like that you want to share? Or maybe the Fairfax Group website, for example, if anybody wants to follow along and learn more?
Well, we do have a website. Like everyone else today, you know, I've gotten past the stage of being a technological dinosaur and have just enough technological information consider myself dangerous. Our website is www.fairfaxgroup.us.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. We will link that up in the show notes if anybody needs any assistance or wants to learn more or anything like that. But it sounds like your company's constantly changing and you already have so many different things going on there as well. It's almost like there's something for everyone.
Well, again, Justin, thank you for your time. Have a great day and let's keep in touch.
We absolutely will. All right. Well, thank you so much, Michael. Take care.
All right. Take care.
If you're interested in more of Spycraft 101, look for my page on Instagram at Spycraft101. You can also find more great articles on my website, spycraft101.com. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll stick around because there's lots more to come.
Disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. The stories and statements expressed herein are experiences and opinions. They may not reflect the views of the host or the production studio. It's okay if you disagree with our content. No piece of media is right for everyone. If you love Spycraft 101, please check us out online, on Instagram, on YouTube, and especially on Patreon. Thank you for listening.